Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm your host, Will Braun. Today, I'll be speaking with Jill Gentile about her book, Feminine Law, Freud, Free Speech, and the Voice of Desire. Jill Gentile authored the book with contributions from Michael McCrone. The book is published by Carnac in 2016. And to say a little something about Dr. Gentile, she's on the faculty of NYU postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, where she's the co-chair of the independent track. She's affiliated with several institutes in the area, some of which are the Institute for Psychoanalytic Study of Subjectivity in New York. She's also a corresponding editor of the Contemporary Psychoanalysis and on the editorial board of the International Journal of Psychoanalytic Self-Psychology. Her essays describing a semiotic and phenomenological trajectory of agency, desire, and symbolic life have been published in many psychoanalytic journals. Dr. Gentile, Jill, welcome to the program.
Hi, Will. Thank you for having me.
Yes, I am very, very excited to be speaking to you today. So, first of all, I just want to say how much I loved your book. I wasn't sure what to expect because there's so much in the title, right? Feminine Law, Freud, Free Speech, The Voice of Desire. And it sounds like it's a dense book, which it is, but I kind of nerded out a little bit. Like there was so much in it to get excited about. So I just want to tell you that, before we begin formally. So.
Well, that's a fantastic beginning because I know it is dense, but to hear your excitement is very thrilling for me as an author, given the ambitions of the book and my desire to reach an audience.
Well, it definitely reached me and took me back to freshman year of college in a seminar I took on democracy. And I remembered a lot of stuff that the teacher taught us, and I was actually quite overwhelmed by the amount of research you did, not only in the psychoanalytic direction, but just with the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my first question to you is, so how did you come to write the book? What sort of sparked this idea, and how did it come together?
Well, you know, it's actually not the most straightforward answer, because it came together in some way the way an analysis proceeds. I started with an interest, a curiosity, a problem, and each question led to new answers and new questions and new gaps and new confusions. So through my practice and my previous writing, I'd become very interested in how personal agency evolves over the course of an analysis. And I've written a great deal about the evolution of personal agency, of the semiotics of desire, and how phenomenology and semiotic empowerment kind of emerge in tandem. So I was already becoming very interested in how language evolves And that led me to this interest in semiotics, led me to this interest in Lacan. And I'd been formerly primarily situated in relational thinking. And alongside of that, I just became intrigued as I'm writing about empowered communication. I'm also becoming increasingly intrigued by how psychoanalysis begins as a relationship of hierarchy. There's a doctor and a patient, or an analyst and analyst.
Mm-hmm.
And that the battleground upon which that emerges, that the patient needs to gain her rights to her free speech, to work, to claim her empowerment as a personal agent, as a sexual agent, as a political agent. And I started to think increasingly about how psychoanalysis becomes this sort of microscopic window into a process of transitional democracy. And once I was there, I just started to become increasingly, it opened up many questions for me. And since, again, I've been writing about speech and the evolution of agentic speech, I landed upon this, to me, this oddity that the First Amendment, in terms of U.S. constitutional democracy, and the foundational rule, the fundamental rule of psychoanalysis of free association, were kind of remarkably analogous, and yet had never been really treated in tandem. And so that opened the door to this puzzle I wanted to solve about the relationship between free speech and free association. Hmm. It started there, and maybe had I been more fully conscious at the time, I would have realized that this project would have inevitably led me onto the path and the terrain of the female body and the quest to signify the body. But that's part of what emerged as the sort of semiotic mystery story of the book. I had not intended to write that, but to solve the problem of free speech, whether it's in psychoanalysis or democracy, it brought me increasingly into the terrain of gender, class, and what I ultimately named feminine law. So that's a long answer to your question.
No, it's a great answer. I mean, I'm really glad you said this, because my sense of the book, in a way, it reads like a free association. So I'm glad that you say that, because you kind of tackle one area, which kind of takes you to another area that opens up the idea of the feminine. And it really flows kind of like a free association would flow from the couch. So I'm really glad that that was kind of your experience writing the book, because that was my experience reading your writing.
Very much. I mean, in fact, Michael McCrone, who was editing and then contributing as a writer to the book, we take a look at the book every 6 months or so and say, this is like a different book now, because I kept needing to reweave and rethread. The book became increasingly layered as these gaps and these questions and these analogies kept opening up. For instance, even beginning with how democracy and psychoanalysis begin in some ways in similar, with a similar set of problems, the sort of wish to overcome repression or as a rebuke to tyranny and to help citizens or patients claim their rights to their own minds, to their own self-sovereignty, and then how that relates to collective sovereignty. These analogies hadn't fully been, they just became more and more intriguing.
Sure. Let's begin with the power of speech, which is really where you begin the book. And so, what is so powerful about speech, and why is it so important?
great question. And again, what's fascinating, when once I stepped into the literature, at least what was unfamiliar to me, completely unfamiliar, was the First Amendment literature. And once I started to mine that literature, I realized there was this other analogy that emerged, which was that the First Amendment literature was filled with all kinds of case law and histories of how we've gained our free speech, a more robust free speech regime in the States. But it didn't really elaborate on why speech mattered, why it's such a core fundamental precept that we've built, that that it's become our prime, you know, we've attached the primacy to speech that we have. And there's a similar resonance in psychoanalysis, where Freud makes this his fundamental rule. He's very committed to it throughout his writing career, and yet he doesn't elaborate it very much. And even though free association has been written about a great deal, it's not written about in a very coherent, it's a very scattered literature. And I think what's left unelaborated is, why do we value, well, first of all, the links between free association and curative speech are left implicit and not particularly explicit. And so we're lacking in both a dedicated discourse about why speech matters. But to answer the question, I think, and Jacques Lacan, I think, is probably the theorist who really comes in and really champions speech in a way that's much more explicit than other theorists. But to Freud's credit, of course, he's the one who landed upon what would become known as the talking cure, thanks to his female patient, Bertha Pappenheim, Anna O, as we affectionately refer to her as. But Freud's path was interesting, right? He began in this age of practice where there was this interest in hypnosis, and he was interested in hypnosis, the practice of mental telepathy, if you will, and he was interested in it as well in practices that involved physical touch. So he was trying to find some sort of direct path to the unconscious. He was trying to find a way that would link conscious with unconscious, but actually would bypass the need for mediation, because he was so interested in truth, right? The idea of an independent truth to unconscious experience. But in the end, the scientist that he was, he recognized that these paths were not providing the empirical and the empiricist that he was. He wasn't landing upon the data, the scientific data that would satisfy him. And what he landed upon instead was that speech was the bridging function, that actually the most direct path to unconscious communication was paradoxically through mediated communication. And so the path between body and mind was connected through speech.
You give this great quote. You quote Freud at the end of the chapter, and you say Freud says, right, words are the most important media by which one man seeks to bring his influence to bear on another. Words are a good method of producing mental change in the person to whom they are addressed. I think that's
the piece that we often leave out, that free association is not just sort of this solipsistic, right, speaking to ourselves in a monologue. And there's much precedent for this in the free association literature. We can look at Bolas, we can look at Anton Criss, we can look at some of the relational literature on free association. Lou Aaron has talked about this, how actually Freud had already intuited what we might see as a democratic process in free association, because Freud named a hearer. He named a partner in the journey of free association, that the patient's mandate was to actually free associate, but in the presence of another, to address his speech to another. Mm-hmm. So that line between how free association enlists the patient into the franchise of speech in a relationship, a human relationship, mm-hmm. Is implicit and in some senses, circumstances explicit. But I think we too often forget that free association is an address. That's why transference analysis is so critical.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see that's missing in the First Amendment and in free speech in most purported democracies is that actually there is this absence of a commitment to the process of hearing, translating, the partnership that's essential to enfranchising the disenfranchised voice.
I mean, it really, a lot of the book brought to mind questions that I have, I guess, about current discourse, in whether it be political or the way speech is mediated through social media, stuff like that today. And I was thinking, I mean, that's so beautifully put when Freud talks about it's an address to a listener. And then I wondered, are we moving towards, this is maybe a bit of a digression from the book, but I think it's your book kind of sparks the question. Do you think that in a way we've stopped listening as a populace, in a way, as a polis? Are we actually speaking, or conversing in an echo chamber to ourselves, like the way that our Facebook feeds kind of just feed us back what we want to hear? Or we watch political parties talk at each other, but there's really no bridging that gap that you really, really highlight in your first chapter?
Well, I try, and I return to it over and over again, because this, again, keeps becoming this this paradoxical tension between freedom and constraint, and that parallels a challenge between the haves and the have-nots. So the bugaboo, you know, kind of democracy, but also in psychoanalysis, is mm-hmm. this problem of equality. And so Tocqueville, years ago, when he first wrote about democracy, came to America, observed close at hand what was going on. He worried that we would end up speaking to ourselves, this sort of solipsism that he anticipated in terms of what he called the semblance, that we would speak to like-minded others, that we would become increasingly, in some ways, polarized, as we actually have. And the I think psychoanalysis in its own discourse kind of reproduced this problem, because over time, right, we split different schools of psychoanalysis from talking with each other. We've not been very effective at talking to the world outside of ourselves. And so, though interestingly, this is a problem that psychoanalysis finally has really tackled theoretically. How do we speak to the other, to the person beyond us? This is what, like, so many current journal articles and conferences are attending to, this idea that we must speak, we must break out of our solipsism into the world beyond us. And so I think that tension in the history of psychoanalysis is paralleled by what we're seeing in public life. And so we see the urgency, we see what's happening in the world right now, Black Lives Matter, Occupy Wall Street, the reaction to something like Citizens United, which has created a widening gap. There's so many widening gaps, so much that it's widened the gap between rich and poor, haves and have-nots. And so what's happened to the listener in a world where the distribution of voice is incredibly inequitably distributed, that there are such gaps in power and access to speech outlets, notwithstanding the democratizing power of the internet, which, of course, not everybody has access to. So I think you're right on that we need to restore a good faith relationship between listeners and hearers.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about the Constitution and the First Amendment and all the paradoxes inherent in freedom, can you give the listeners just kind of a brief history, which part of it, this is when I was nerding out, I sort of loved the historical perspective of the Constitution and the First Amendment, that, you know, what I think of as free speech protections has not always been the case. And the Supreme Court did not always see the First Amendment the way that a 2016 person might see it. So can you give us a brief kind of overview of the way the First Amendment has been viewed through history?
Well, it's a great question again, and complicated, and I don't know that I can do justice to it in a short amount of time, but what I can say is that right from the get-go, first of all, there was argument about whether we were even going to have a Bill of Rights and what the sequence of the Bill of Rights would be, mm-hmm. finally concluding with the Free Speech Amendment as the First Amendment. Although what we forget about the First Amendment is that it's actually a series of clauses, and it includes the one we focus most, and what I focus mostly on in the book, is the freedom of speech. But it says, essentially, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech, but also freedom of the press, free exercise of religion, freedom of assembly, freedom to petition the government. It's, as Bert Newborn, a constitutional scholar, has written, it's really a poetic blueprint for democracy in action. When you look at the sequence of each of the clauses, and actually it didn't actually list the clauses in order, but there's a way in which it links freedom of thought to freedom of speech to then these sort of collective freedoms and the power of the press to kind of provide a checks and balance function. So all of this is embedded in the First Amendment. Then what happens is we establish the First Amendment because we're a new government, and it's a fragile government. It is erecting itself in response to tyranny from Britain, from the homeland. But the idea of protecting the government was at first much more of a priority than protecting anything that we've come to think about it nowadays in terms of minority voice or even the majority voice. So quite early on, there's a Sedition Act, and there's there are prosecutions for criticizing the government, criticizing Jefferson or John Adams. I think John Adams left Congress to pass the Sedition Act. Mm-hmm. So we see the vulnerability of the government, and they're accustomed to a certain kind of aristocracy and to a silencing of the people. And that then is mirrored over time in history, where every time there's a major threat, and by the way, at that time, the founders are also witnessing what's going on in the French Revolution. And there's the fear of what can happen if mass democracy, if you will, kind of gains traction. And so there's also this tension, right, always and reverberates today between elitism and populism. So every time there's another war, there's this tension or a threat of war, a threat to the government. But we see, for instance, in World War I and World War II, these conservative forces that start to kind of restrict freedom of speech and limit the will of the majority, to punish speech that is offensive to the government. So stuff that seems amazing to us nowadays, when we think that in the early part of the 20th century, draft resistors were seen as outside of the realm of the First Amendment and were actually prosecuted and tried and punished and sentenced, often to harsh sentences, for distributing things like leaflets against the war or advocating for draft resistance, that kind of thing. So we've made a lot of progress, but then again, in the Second World War, right, we see the internment of the Japanese. We see this way in which there's fear and retaliation is the kind of counterpoint to freedom, and that we never quite trust the voice of desire, of the people's desire. And so that tension goes back and forth. But over time, as the government, I think as the government became more secure, as after the civil rights, the Civil War, there's a great deal of rhetoric during the Civil War that helped to promote the robustness of the First Amendment, which speaks to the power itself of free speech, because the rhetoric that surrounded the Civil War was so... like the appeal to liberation, the appeal to equality, to the dream of free speech was so incandescent. It just sparked so much enthusiasm. It really changed hearts and minds. So speech has this power. And so we see the movements against slavery and towards emancipation and towards this liberatory impulse and towards the Equal Rights Amendment. And so there's this movement, progressive movement, that then is linked with periods of regression over and over. We see the same parallel in psychoanalysis, where there's periods of opening a space and then these very conservative impulses that kind of become more... a more authoritarian or conservative orthodoxy that sets in. But the first real victories for minority speech come in the 20th century. It's not until 1931 that a free speech claim actually wins. And that is often seen as what sets in our modern day love affair with the First Amendment. And again, rhetoric and speech had a huge impact on the public's conception of the First Amendment. So we have these major dissents written by Louis Brandeis and Justice Holmes and others, but really, this remarkable rhetoric that is so powerful that it kind of seeps into people's hearts and minds about, and I don't have the quotes in front of me, but the courage to be truthful and to not live in tyranny and not live in hatred and fear, and that inert people. These quotes could have been written by Freud.
Yeah,
who, of course, was not exactly a fan of America, but
that's the parallel.
All of this is going on simultaneously.
That's the parallel that I think is so great that you draw. That here we have, I'd forgotten about the founding fathers. With all of the patriotism or Americanism or whatever that's going on right now, one would imagine, or if you watch Fox News, one might imagine that the founding fathers were champions of freedom of expression, but really they were quite concerned about mob rule. And you draw the same parallel with Freud, that Freud had the same tension. He was all about freedom of speech, yet we need to be careful about freedom of speech. How much freedom? Where's the role of repression? And that repression is a good thing, not always a bad thing. And where's the balance?
It's an ongoing conversation. Really, throughout the case law of the First Amendment, this is this ongoing tension of where, and it starts with John Mills and John Stuart Mill about the idea of individual liberty is based in natural rights, And that liberty starts and stops where the other, where it infringes on the other person's right, natural rights. Mm-hmm. And so, and where it begins to do harm to another. Now, Freud, as we know, is all about release of instinct and freedom from repression until World War breaks out and he suffers some personal losses in his own life that are quite devastating to him. And we see that his pioneering and, you know, initial exuberance about what the possibilities would be for languaging the body. He starts to grow more cautious, more pessimistic, more conservative, and then sees as the new gold standard of cure this idea of compromise formation, mm-hmm. that individual liberty must always meet some counterbalance in terms of the needs of the collective. So some of the constitutional writers on this talk about this as a balancing act. They're not talking about Freud, but they're talking about balancing of individual and collective rights. So we see this over and over and over and over. I would say that I think psychoanalysis has a lot to contribute to this discourse, especially what's emerging nowadays. And I want to privilege in this sense what's happening within relational thinking and intersubjectivity, mm-hmm. literature in particular, because I think what we're discovering increasingly is that personal agency, the singularity of desire and freedom of expression, emerges in tandem with mutual recognition. It's not actually in opposition to, but actually that we can't really have a victory in the field of freedom of expression unless we also surrender to a kind of mutuality of recognition and a mutuality of desire. So, in other words, we can't win this victory alone. We need each other. And that means we need to surrender to the listener, the hearer, the voice, the body of the other. And so there's no zero-sum solution.
You raise a question in the book about free speech for whom? And you speak about excluded voices, you know, and it is amazing, you know, that Freud really begins his science, his discovery, his journey with the silenced voices of women that, you know, were not necessarily voices that were heard in Fin de Siècle Vienna. One of the questions that I had, you give a great history about excluded voices in America in relation to our own democracy and freedom of speech. But I was also thinking about the current state of psychoanalysis. And are we doing a good enough job enfranchising excluded voices?
Well, it's not a battle that we can win one time. It's not a single, you know, one-time victory. It's really a battle that needs to be fought and won, I think, in each generation, in society and in analysis and in each individual analysis. But it's another place where public life and psychoanalytic life actually intersect, because while both were predicated upon exclusions, right, we know that the First Amendment and the Constitution initially excluded the franchise of slaves, of women, and only many years later did both gain the rights to vote. But psychoanalysis initially excluded people based on their diagnosis, people who were just gays, and there were various pathologies that were excluded, borderline narcissistic disorders. So we see that the franchise of who was eligible for psychoanalysis gradually was increased. And that was especially the case after traumas of World War I and especially World War II, where there was a much more activist approach to psychoanalysis and to helping previously marginalized groups and voices get access to psychoanalysis. But then technique also changed, right? We had a more activist technique. So now we could treat beyond neurotic problems. We could treat problems of trauma and developmental and economic and environmental deprivation. But we still have a very long ways to go, because any of us who attend psychoanalytic conferences knows that we're mainly preaching to our own choirs, mm-hmm. and preaching to a very white audience, a group of white analysts.
Exactly.
And we know how expensive it is to participate in a sustained psychoanalysis. We know how much mental health benefits and for people who do have health insurance, and now with Obamacare, many more people have access to health insurance, and yet mental health coverage has been massively chipped away at for many people who are seeking psychotherapy. So the question of whether a commitment to free speech really needs to involve a commitment to some sort of psychotherapy privilege, because we need to offer in society means by which people can begin to access their human symbolic potential. But if we as a symbolic species are speaking, signing creatures, but we develop our capacity to speak and to hear in relationship, if we're deprived of the kinds of relationship that help to enfranchise us in a speaking, hearing community, then society's failing us, and psychoanalysis then also starts to fail members of society. So we need, in this sense, psychoanalysts need to also lobby outside of their practices to call attention to these inequities that pervade our practices as analysts, and often underscore the huge class differences, racial differences, and gaps in access to power and privilege. Because speaking is actually, even if we have a First Amendment right, it's something that we need a partner to help us to gain that privilege and to exercise it.
You talk about the importance for symbolic discourse and why it's important for the space for symbolic discourse to be fostered. I wonder if you could just briefly state for the listeners who might not be familiar with that term, what is it that you mean by symbolic discourse, and how do we as psychoanalysts create a space that facilitates symbolic discourse?
It's a huge question. And a great question, and it takes up a big part of my book. So Freud's interest is, right, the gaps in association. He invites the patient to free associate. Patient, actually, the first thing we learn as analysts is that people can't free associate. They constantly interrupt their speech. They become derailed, there are impasses, there are impediments. There are all kinds of constraints, but the constraints actually help to create a space for speech. And so part of my argument here is that we talk about free association, we talk about free speech. Now, right now I'm collapsing them, conflating them, even though there's an important difference between them. But at least one important difference, but others. But if we need to bring our free associations into speech, we need to bring our body into speech between mind and body. Well, we're already talking about the emergence of a dialectical space between listener and speaker, between body and mind, between the disenfranchised and the enfranchised, between the haves and the have-nots. We're talking about how, and we see in these various court decisions, how the Supreme Court has struggled with finding boundaries to speech that create a space for speech. In other words, do people have the right to protest in the streets, and to what degree? Do people have the rights to vote? So all of these questions, do they have the right to burn a flag or burn a draft card? What are the limits of hate speech? Is hate speech free speech? And these are all questions that are actually really profoundly considered by psychoanalysis, but we don't usually use that language. So most of psychoanalysis we think of as cultivating free expression, and yet we mostly think that regulating or censoring speech is antithetical to the psychoanalytic project and to the democratic project. But because what we discover is that there ain't such a thing as free speech, that free speech is cultivated in the context and is conditioned by constraint, we're all the time fostering this space. So what are the constraints there? We need to concede to the use of language. We need to concede to the idea that our free speech is actually conditioned by unconscious life. It's to a large degree overdetermined. So that's part of the paradox of freedom. It's a space between freedom and surrender to unconscious communication and dynamics. One of Freud's central discoveries, obviously, was the constraint of transference, that the patient is invited to speak, but then is constrained by the relationship, which becomes both his obstacle but ally to cure. So there are all these ways that we start to see how speech begins to be opened and shut down and opened. And along the way, what I start to observe as I'm doing this research is that there's this way in which silence is a lot of, almost more than free association. There's so many journal articles on silence. And so I become interested in this idea of what silence is communicating and how silence seems to shut down a space even as it opens up a space of resistance. And there's this period, like in the 1950s or so, when it seems that mainly male analysts are writing about silence. And they're writing about this idea of the patient's impediment to free association, that they have nothing to say. And then that leads into this question of what the word nothing means. And that lands on this series of papers that is written and then sort of dropped. It seems like it doesn't get taken up again in literature, where this idea of silence and nothing to say is associated to the nothing of the female body, and specifically the female genital body, that what is unspoken is the female vagina. And so this becomes, for me, the quintessential metaphor of space. How do I get there is a more complicated question, but I would just briefly say that along the way, psychoanalysis has started to privilege all of these metaphors of space. So we've been increasingly searching for how to create space and how to set boundaries to create space. This is what the whole literature, I think we can look at the whole literature on enactments in terms of how do we move beyond coercive communication that shuts down space, that disowns agency, to opening a space for ownership, for agency, and actually for the physical body to reemerge in psychoanalysis, and therefore what I'll call the voice of desire. So anyway, it's a very long answer, but
no, that's great.
It, all of these metaphors of space start calling attention to our need to reclaim an idea of symbolic space, that free speech is not just say whatever comes to mind, but it actually is say what comes to mind and be honest. It's already a space between freedom and honesty. And we see this tension of how freedom is always harnessed by constraint. And in the end, symbolic space, once it's grounded to the, in the body, also grounds us to reality. An important point when we look at like the rhetoric of someone like Donald Trump, who says whatever comes to mind, but with no accountability to reality. So this is a huge contribution, I think, psychoanalysis, something psychoanalysis really understands and can contribute to the public discourse.
You know, it reminds me of a conversation I had with Esther Sperber, a friend of ours, architect. And I never really thought about space in a way until you talk to an architect who deals in space constantly, right? And she said architecture is basically defining space. Or it's putting the limit or the boundary on the space. And I never really thought about architecture being, you know, what was inside the building. But that's exactly the most important part. It's what we use. It's not the space itself. It's the space itself. It's not the structure. It's what's sort of inside the space.
It's the tension between both, but without the structure, we can't. We can't really access the space without some protective structure. And yet, if it's all about the building or the thing itself, we're back in, you know, with Freud's original problem. Is it, do we touch the body to heal the body and mind, or do we have to do something different? Because otherwise we collapse. Like Winnicott, I love Winnicott's work partly because he was so disciplined about this. His idea of the transitional phenomenon and the transitional object is that the symbol is born between reality, the real teddy bear, and the subject's imagination, the subject's fantasy. And it's that space between that's where democratic life prospers, that's where symbolic life prospers. But when we don't have an equitable, you know, some equality in the franchise of speech, the symbolic terrain gets really bottled up, just the way a patient's body gets becomes symptomatic. The public sphere of discourse becomes symptomatic. Congealed in symptoms.
Can you speak about the importance of naming? I mean, we talk about the space, but you really stress in your book the importance of naming the space, naming the gap, symbolizing the feminine space, naming desire, naming truth. Can you speak to the importance of naming?
Yeah. Well, again, I think we don't emphasize it enough in psychoanalysis, but without naming, we don't have knowledge. And of course, in psychoanalysis, we're interested in the freedom to be curious, to know, to name. We're interested in truths that we can name that are, if they're not nameable, if they're not spoken, they remain hidden and obscured. And so if we're always interested in pushing the envelope to discover new truths, novel truths, hidden truths, we need to have the courage and strength to name the frontier of what's unnamed. Okay, I was just changing a receiver there. So this again brought me back to this question of why have we enabled a psychoanalysis that continues to privilege the phallic symbol and to continue to degrade and leave obscured and unnamed the vaginal symbol? And how from the get-go, I mean, when you think about the whole project of psychoanalysis, Freud, I mean, he's such a masterful storyteller as well as, you know, had such a brilliant scientific mind. And however misogynistic he may have been, he's certainly a man of his times and of many, maybe of any time, but he had this curious way, right, of simultaneously listening to women's voices and silencing them, speaking over them, and treating female sexuality and the female and female genitalia as inferior, while privileging the destiny of the male penis envy, and the phallus. But in some ways, his most brilliant theorizing begins at the beginning, right? We must make meaning of anatomy. And what inspires curiosity and what awakens the child's scientific mind, right, is the discovery of genital difference, of anatomical difference. The boy has a penis and the girl doesn't. This discovery of difference, right, difference, instead of being difference as something to ignore or reject or annihilate, difference inspires the whole psychoanalytic project. We could say it inspires the whole democratic project. Difference awakens the child's mind. How to make meaning of this difference? So if we don't just, take the most, more negative interpretations of Freud, but look at this sort of very bold streak he makes, we could say that this is the opening up of a space for curiosity. It's the space that's in the absence of the penis. There's a space that inspires curiosity. But unfortunately, Freud filled that space in with a lot of phallocentric theorizing, as did many subsequent generations of analysts. And so we want to remember to name that space. We want to name female voice, female body. We want to name what's unnameable that pushes us to the frontiers of knowing. And here I cite the work of the French philosopher Badiou, because I think his project on naming the unnameable, and it's this endless infinite, it brings us into part of the beauty and mystery of psychoanalysis. It's an unfinished project, just as democracy always will be, because we can never perfectly fill in the gap. It will always, once we do that, we're back to the realm of dogma and tyranny. But when we keep that space open, and I want to use again the metaphor of the female space, the female genital space, to say that when we can keep that space open, there's actually room for a potent discourse. There's room for the interpenetration between vaginal symbols and phallic symbols. There's room for the interpenetration and intercourse of exciting, new, maybe threatening, scary, but vitalizing ideas, and for tapping into the energetic, the reverberant dimensions of the female genital cavity, the bodily energies that, again, psychoanalysis sort of moved away from. And that's implicit in the First Amendment, right? We have the right to physical assembly. We have the right to bring our bodies into collective sphere, into shared communication. And, unfortunately, what we see is that the police, that there's a tension between freedom and constraint there. While we need some boundary, too often that degrades into a kind of control, again, a phallocentric control of the physical body when it's in public space and in intimate interaction.
I think that is so beautifully put.
Mm.
That was fantastic. I feel like we could wrap up right with that comment. We're coming to the end, but I want to read a quote towards the end of your book from page 242. I think it kind of sums up what we're talking about, but I think you actually just said it very beautifully. You say on page 242, while it is true that not everyone can have a vagina, we all can and must claim its symbolic space, the vaginal space. It's not a symbol of invisibility or inferiority. In naming it, we bring space into presence. Its receptivity and responsiveness open to the possibility for mystery and for knowledge. We may dread naming and knowing, but we also desire them. That desire is itself dependent on naming and knowing what lies at the brink of what cannot be fully known. Desire is actually born in our very need to claim it, to experience and sustain receptivity, to sustain a reverberant gap, a feminine space births desire. I love that. That's exactly what you were just saying.
Yeah, it came, you know, through the writing of this book and through contemplating all of this, I kept returning to how gender becomes a metaphor for all of the gaps. And for if we don't begin to name and deal, at least within psychoanalysis, but also symbolic life in the cultural sphere, we lose a huge opportunity to begin to level the playing field. And if we don't level the playing field, we'll always have a public discourse, and we see it in the clinic. We see how our patients struggle with resentments and hate born of inequities, of the way life has been unfair for them, the way the treatment is grounded in something that in a power dynamic that feels disenfranchising and inhuman in some way, mm-hmm. and or dehumanizing. And so I think it's a very powerful metaphor, and the more we can claim this space and privilege it and not degrade it, I think we open a sphere where psychoanalysis and democracy can both prosper, and where symbolic life, free, genuine free speech and the content of experience that goes with genuine free speech, which I think is much more of a discourse of love, of recognition, of mutual recognition, of sharing. And it sounds sort of like pie in the sky and sentimental, but I believe that clinical experience shows this to be the case, that as we move out of our patients' hate speech, as we translate their hate, as we bear the burden of their grievances and wounds, and as we also enlist them into enfranchisement, and as we are willing to concede losses to our own privileged protective role as analysts, to genuinely create a more inclusive level playing field that everybody starts to win.
Well, we're coming to the end of our interview. Jill, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, Will, fabulous questions, and it's been such a privilege. And
really,
pleasure.
What are you currently working on? Are you working on something new, or what can we look forward to?
Well, I'm continuing now to work on finding a way to translate more of this book into more public discourse possibilities, like blogs and that kind of thing, because I want to try to reach an audience beyond psychoanalysts. And I'm increasingly fascinated and interested in this question of inequality. And so that's sort of an ongoing quest and hunger to focus my work on how sexuality, race, class, all of the inequities how speech can begin to bridge these gaps. No, not stopping anytime soon.
Good.
Unless they write questions.
Good. Well, the book is Feminine Law, Freud, Free Speech, and the Voice of Desire by Jill Gentile with Michael Macrone. Sorry, I've gotten that wrong so many times. Jill, thank you so much again for speaking with us.
My pleasure. So great appreciation. Well, thank you for such great questions.